Alright, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 59 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the story of the decline and fall of Greece. I really should have entitled that last lecture, The Decline and Fall of Greece, Part 1. The Peloponnesian War is the first chapter in this long period, this long, sad, tragic period in human history that we're going to now continue to chart the course of here. And so it's so tragic because if the Greeks had learned to live together, if they had found a way to unite, I am... my thought concerning what the consequence would be for humanity is almost hard to, it's almost hard to imagine how wonderful it could have been. And just some idea of how significant it might have been, we can glean from the founding fathers and their thinking with regard to ancient history. Because when they looked back on Greece, and then they looked on Rome, and they especially worked with those two examples, which were so instructive to them, there was one thing that stood out to them about the difference. There was one thing, especially when they looked at Greece, that they took away from the history of Greece, and they said, that is the one thing we can't let happen to us. And it was the failure to unite. So think about this in connection to American history. What did they do? What was that camp in the American Revolution that said we have to create a single country with a single government? What were they called? James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay. They were the champions of this view. Keen?
The Federalists.
Exactly. At the end of the Revolution, the founding fathers were in two camps. Some of them said, we can get along just fine as 13 separate countries. And the other, the Federalists, said, no, we can't. And they argued, it was a tough argument. And there were some good reasons not to unite. And one of my personal favorites, Patrick Henry, was an anti-Federalist. Thomas Jefferson didn't really play a big role in this particular part of the history. But John Adams was a Federalist. George Washington was a Federalist. They were not the main ones. James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay were the main ones. But they were Federalists. And what was their point? Well, it was partly exposed in that essay that we've talked about before, even this year. Federalist number 10 was one of the arguments. And the point was that union was better for rights. And that was the fundamental challenge they were trying to face, was how to create a country of individual rights. What would be the best way to secure rights now that they had declared independence and said that the reason why was individual rights? Well, how do you create a government for individual rights? Well, the Federalists said, we've got to create a single overarching government for these states, because the disaster for us is going to be if we fail to unite. And they really had a long argument about this. And in the end, the Federalists won. And, well, the outcome is precisely what we see in world history. The outcome is that the United States rose up from being a colonial footnote in history. A small part of the British Empire that nobody in Europe could have imagined would be important. rose up from that to being the greatest country in the history of the world. A country that put a man on the moon. And that in this century will put a man on Mars. And so on. A country that saved the world from itself three times over in the past century. And in its founding principles, as the freest country ever created, became the wealthiest, most powerful country in the history of the world. I mean, wow. The Federalists got it right. None of that would have happened in the arrangement of the Anti-Federalists. They were wrong. Now, there are problems with it, and the United States is not perfect, and nobody in their right mind could claim that it is, but nothing of this greatness that is the United States could have occurred without the union of the various states. Despite their differences, they were able to find that common ground and create the country. And then even later on, generations later, finally get rid of slavery through the Civil War. I mean, all of this heroic progression is just amazing. It is unprecedented in human history. And its name is the United States of America. So they did it. They united and they created the greatest country in the history of the world. Now imagine if the Greeks had done that. I mean, the Greeks were the ones that first identified all of the ingredients that you need in order to create a United States. So in the Athenian Golden Age, they've got a free society politically, freer than ever. They had its problems. Democracy is not as good as republic, but it was better than anything else, and they could have continued because they had philosophy, they had history, they had art. And they were starting to have science. They had all the ingredients you need for greatness in a modern country. Everything that created the United States. And so imagine then if they had been able to get over their differences and unite. And if the Athenian Golden Age hadn't ended, if it had just continued, generation after generation after generation, and spread throughout Greece. And then the Greeks met the Romans on equal terms and taught the Romans how to be more civilized and learned what the Romans had done in their republic, which we're going to learn about in the next segment, and combined to make an even better government for each of them side by side. And, well, I know it sounds like some kind of massive what if, which is what it is, but imagine if there had never been a Dark Ages. Imagine if you got Greece and Rome side by side, allies in the world, in the Mediterranean, at beacons of civilization, and the Dark Ages never happened. Imagine if you don't have to wait 1,000 years for the Renaissance. Because there is no Dark Age. Because just society continues to progress from the original flowering of the Golden Age. You don't have to have the intervening Dark Ages. So basically, mankind is 1,000 years ahead of itself. Try to imagine that. So here we are in 2000 plus AD. Imagine if the society that we have had come into being in 1000 AD. A full 1,000 years ahead. Where would we be now?
that should be enough to just blow your minds, right? And, I mean, it is, of course, one gigantic what if. But the point is, the United States united and became the greatest country in the world. And what if Greece had united and then somehow peacefully united with Rome? That outcome would have been the United States way over 1,000 years before the United States ever happened. Without the need of 1,000-year dark age. That is mind-boggling. So it's really, really sad. This decline and fall of Greece is the greatest tragedy in the history of mankind. It's just very, very sad. The Greeks were so amazing. They were so wonderful. They're inventing all this new stuff. And I tried to capture, you know, the significance of it for you guys by showing you that painting of the School of Athens and saying to you, you know, showing you guys, well, the Renaissance people recognized this value, right? And they finally embraced it. And then the founders embraced the political dimension of it. And now we get the modern world. Well, what if we didn't have to wait all this time for that? And Timothy, you know what? That is a more profound comment than you might realize. The Greeks invented so many different things. They invented much of what we call literature. I mean, there were a lot simpler forms of literature before Greek literature. But one of the things that they did, which is very Greek, is very much this concept of tragedies, as in terms of. Theater, and the Greeks definitely advanced that art as well, and tragedies were one of the forms of art that they were most well known for. And yeah, there was a tragic quality to Greek culture. There was a kind of fatalism to Greek culture, because on the one hand, the Greeks could see so much, they could imagine so much, they could project this possibility for mankind that was different. A whole other level, a whole other plateau, well, not the archaic one that they were stuck on, but a whole other way of life. And that's our way of life that they were trying to imagine. But they couldn't get there. So yeah, they do have a tragic quality, and you see it in their art, and more in the art that we'll take a look at some of it possibly here, in what's called Hellenistic art. It becomes that much more dark, and the themes are more malevolent, and the sense of life is declining, the sense that the world can be shaped in for positive values and made better and so on. You can see it draining out of the Greeks. They become bitter. They become less and less capable of projecting their values until ultimately, when they're conquered by the Romans, they are just a shambles compared to what they were. So yeah, it is a really sad story, and the Peloponnesian War is chapter one in this decline and fall, because they had just defeated the Persians. This is the great outcome that they needed in order to have the flowering in the first place. And then they couldn't find a way to coexist. So I'm not going to point the finger, because I wouldn't presume to be able to say if it was one person's fault or the fault of some leaders or any such thing. It is what happened, and I don't think we could possibly have enough evidence to place the blame on anybody. But you know, and it would be very presumptuous of us from the present to look back and say, "Well, you Athens and Sparta, why couldn't you get along?" Right? And so it's like, why couldn't the United States and the Soviet Union get along? Well, there's good reasons why. And so, you know, we shouldn't presume to look back and say, why couldn't they? But they didn't, unfortunately. And the cost for humanity is just beyond measure. It's 1,000 years of human misery, at least. So the Spartans conquered Athens, and now they're going to impose their will on the Athenians, which is the worst possible outcome for Greece. What are they going to do? Well, the Spartans are not. They're not the Persians who would let you have your own government, right? So they're definitely not going to let the Athenians keep their democracy. Instead, the Spartans got a set of aristocrats who were willing to do Sparta's bidding and put them in charge of the government. And it's a very peculiar arrangement, unique and short-lived, so we're not going to spend too much time talking about it. It's called, the name of this group was, in history, is called the 30 Tyrants. I'll type it for you in the chat. The 30 Tyrants, which is a confusing name. It's from, now they were in power from 404 to 403 BC, for anybody who wants that. So right at the end of the war goes till 404, 30 Tyrants are put in charge by the Spartans. It didn't last long, a little over a year. And it's a strange name, right? Because when we think of a tyrant, we think of a tyrannos. So that's an association that's hard to shake now that we've studied Greek history. A tyrannos is what? Juliet?
A leader chosen by the people.
Okay, right, but that's not what this is, right? So it's not the 30 tyrannoi. In a way, the 30 tyrants is really much more tyrant in the way that we use the word tyrant in the modern language, which means an unjust ruler, which is almost, what do we call that word? There's a great word for that. It's a word that means a repetition. Darn, I forgot it. It's a really good vocabulary word. Anyway, it's when you say the same thing twice, an unjust ruler. Well, anyway, so that's how we think of a tyrant, like King John of England, upon whom the Magna Carta was forced, right? That's more what this was. This was 30 aristocrats, power-lusting, you know, who wanted to get back at the democracy, and taking advantage of the war to put themselves into power, to do Sparta's bidding. They killed thousands of democrats, in other words, thousands of the leaders of Athenian democracy. And so Athens was tearing itself apart, and Sparta was plenty happy with that. Now, they didn't want to... One strange thing about the way that Sparta acted at the end of the war is they didn't want to get rid of Athens. They could have totally wiped it out. Now, I guess we could go back to our maps and stuff. Right, so here we've got the Athenian League in orange, and we've got the purple, the Spartan and its allies. Sparta didn't want to get rid of Athens entirely. Now, this is kind of a perplexing thing in a way. Why wouldn't you want to destroy your enemy entirely? Well, part of the reason has to do with the fact that in the Peloponnesian War, Sparta could posture as a kind of champion of Greek liberty. As perverse as that might sound. Why could Sparta make such a claim? Why could it posture as being a kind of positive force in Greece?
Keen?
Because Athens had become so controlling of its of the member city states of the league, and as you said, it had become the Athenian Empire.
There, exactly right. So the Delian League had become the Athenian Empire, and so Sparta and they were begging Sparta for help, and so Sparta could conquer Athens and kind of be righteous about it. They could say, "This isn't just us being these conquerors for no good purpose. This is us liberating Greece from Athens." Okay, but the reality is Sparta is not the kind of place that can liberate anybody, right? They were not going to have some kind of beneficent effect on the rest of Greece. Nobody was going to be happy to have Sparta in charge. They might have short-sightedly have thought, yeah, we don't want Athens in charge. But you know what? If you don't want Athens in charge, just wait till Sparta's in charge. Right? Then you'll know what you really didn't want. Now, there was a limit to this, though. There was a limit to what Sparta could do. It was a single city-state, and Greece had not been unified before, and Sparta was not going to have an easy time maintaining control over the other city-states. And the Spartans decided, and this is kind of the weird part, is they decided not to destroy Athens, because they decided that controlling Greece was easier with Athens in it. Does that make sense? Can anybody make sense of that? Why not destroy your enemy, your one great rival? Instead of destroying Athens, the Spartans crippled it. Better or worse? I mean, for Sparta, you see, the calculation was that this would serve Sparta's interests to have a crippled Athens in Greece rather than no Athens. Can anybody see why? Keen?
Well, as long as you can control Athens or control your enemy, if you bend them to your will, then you can use their power. You can use them like a slave. They will do your bidding. They'll be able to. You'll have an asset.
Okay, yeah, that was part of the concept, that Athens, in effect, would be a Spartan asset from now on, and it would be one of the pieces that you can move in this board game that is Greek warfare and Greek rivalry between the city-states. In fact, basically, the Spartans were thinking of Athens as a piece in the balance of power, a useful piece. Because basically, the balance of power in Greece was multifaceted, right? It wasn't just Sparta and Athens. Yes, they were the two dominant ones. But if Sparta all of a sudden is the only dominant one, then what happens? Juliet?
The others will try to overthrow it.
Yeah, then Sparta becomes... Then you get a big target on your back, right? Being number one means everybody's targeting you. Which is how the United States feels. So, right, in modern times. Right, so you're when you get to the top, then everybody's trying to tear you down. And so now Sparta is going to be on top, and that's a tricky place to be. And you now, if everybody's ill will is concentrated on you, then you're in trouble. Now, so Sparta wants to keep Athens around because there's other city-states like Corinth and Thebes that are, well, they're trouble. They're Greek, you know. I mean, the Greeks are, they're trouble. And Spartans know all about that. They're Greeks. And so it's hard to manage these characters. It's better if you can play them off of each other. It's better if you can have Athens over here as a target of the ambitions of other city-states, but also, in a way, perhaps something that they're afraid of. And, you know, you can always... It's better to have these pieces to work with than not have one here. Then you have a more direct confrontation with the other city-states. So the Spartans decided to leave Athens there, even in its crippled state. The 30 tyrants didn't last. The democracy was restored. But Athens was much weaker than ever before. So it now was way down in rank in terms of the most powerful city-states in Greece. But pretty soon,
Sparta's going to find that none of these... What the Spartans were going to find was there's no such thing as the balance of power. It's an illusion. At best, what you get when you try to manipulate circumstances so that you get a so-called balance, at best, in your favor, right? You always want it to be a quote, balance. But really what you are trying to do is establish it so that you're always a little bit stronger than everybody else, but not too much, because then this was Sparta's problem. If you're too strong, then everybody turns against you. But on the other hand, if you can balance things just in this delicate sort of way, then things are always in your favor, just slightly. But it's an illusion. Never a balance never has that permanent quality. It's always shifting. Somebody's always making calculations. Somebody is always interfering or tilting the balance one way or another, and it always falls apart. And in a way, the Spartans accidentally tilted the balance themselves, because they decided to interfere in the Persian Empire. So here we have a really interesting kind of the tables got turned, right? We know that the Greeks deflected the Persian Empire's invasion, and then now we're focusing all on Greece. Well, what was happening in Persia all this time now that they lost? What happens inside of a huge empire that's made this huge, really big effort to conquer someplace and they fail? And they go back home with their tails between their legs. Now what? What happens inside of an empire like that? That's always a difficult situation for an empire. And we've talked about this before, that empires have a kind of life cycle of that is very inherent in the manner of their existence. Empires have to grow. The way that they are. So long as the fundamental mode of conduct of the rulers of an empire remains imperialism, that's how they live, then an empire simply has to grow. And if it doesn't, it collapses. Does anybody remember some of why that is? Can anybody think of why that might be? Like I said, it has to do with the mode of conduct of an empire. If you're not growing, you're failing. You're not just, there's no way for an empire to just sit still. An empire has to grow. Which is why when you see an empire reach its peak, you know it's in trouble. It's going to die. Why is that? What is the imperial mode of conduct? It's the archaic plateau. It's a special kind of feature of the archaic plateau. How do you live if you're an imperialist? Keen?
You have to take other people's things. It's like your resources and your sustenance comes from not producing things by yourself, but taking things from other people.
Right. I mean, because if you're the Persians, let's say, right? You've got your own country, your own kingdom. You're going to grow a certain amount of food. You're going to have a certain kingdom all by yourself, and that you can sustain in that small form. Or Greece, or Egypt, or Mesopotamia. And you find all kinds of these small kingdoms all scattered throughout the world at this archaic level. And that is reasonably sustainable. I mean, you're always going to have famines and pestilence and all the problems of life, you know, without science and technology. So it's never going to be nice. But you can manage it. Especially if you're in a nice river valley or something like that, right? So you can manage it. But then the minute you decide you want to expand and you're going to undertake to conquer other people in order to get more. Well, that's the mode of conduct that you then accept. That the way to have more is you have to take it from others. And that's where what it is. That is the truth of it at the archaic plateau. There's no other way. Now, the modern answer, which the Greeks taught us, is to think and to apply a rational process of thought to the problems of survival, to understand nature through science, to apply scientific knowledge through technology, and through business innovation and the creation of wealth and material values, and you create values. That's the modern answer. That's now when you're not having to live at the archaic plateau anymore. But if you're stuck on that plateau, you haven't risen up from it yet. Well, the only way to get more is to take it from somebody else. But that imperial conduct has a certain logic to it. You're going to go, you're going to beat up somebody else and take their stuff. Force them to work from you and then put them under the yoke. And you will have a little bit more because of that. And then, all right, you get to kind of a certain point. You've got to manage them. You've got a whole new set of challenges that you have to put your energy into. And that's hard to do. Now, in order to succeed, you need to keep going. You leverage that. You take over those people. You force them to work for you. You go and you conquer somebody else and you take what they got. And so on and so on and so on. And if you're the Persians, you're really good at it, then you get a really huge empire. Which kind of came out to be, well, let me give you the full map, is this one, right? Persian Empire is like a 490 BC, about the biggest it ever got. All right, so you get this giant thing. And if you're smart, like the Persians, you come up with ways to make the people inside the empire less desirous of murdering you in your sleep and rebelling and so on, right? So you can make it bigger. But there's a limit to how much you can accomplish. Because as the empire gets bigger, you get more of two kinds of enemies. You get, your border keeps getting bigger and bigger. Right? The territory you're controlling is bigger and bigger. That means you've got more and more people on the outside that don't like you. People that you've pushed out of your empire, or people that you've run up against that you can't conquer, and you've got more and more of those because your empire is bigger and bigger. As your circumference of your empire gets larger, right, the more enemies you've got on the outside. And what other kinds of enemies do you have? You got more on the outside and more on the... No matter how nice you are, on the inside. Right? Because you're ruling them, and yeah, you might let them have their local governments, and you might let them keep their religions and so on. Right? What you're doing there, you're not making them happy, but you're making them less angry, but there's still more and more of them, and you have, it's harder and harder for you to control them. There's a limit. Then when you hit that limit, where you're not able to then extract resources from more and more people all the time, well, then a number of things tend to happen. A cascade of problems tends to occur that destroy empires. One is you've got all those external enemies you've got to face off against, and that creates a lot of pressure on the outside. Then you've got internal enemies that are rebelling. That creates a lot of problems on the inside. But more, probably the worst part of it, and this is, you see it in Rome, you see it everywhere you look in empires. The worst part is what it's done to you to live that way. What kind of people you have become in order to do all this. And so what you see in Persia, which we're going to see just very briefly here now, and we're going to see it in the Roman Empire as well later on, and other empires everywhere you look. Your mode of conduct is taking from others. Let's see if you can work out the logic. This is all you know how to do. So now you've run out of new people to take stuff from. What do you do? Get the hint? If you know the history of Rome, or you know the history of other empires, you'll know what comes next. You don't have anybody else to take stuff from. So, Keen?
You take stuff from each other.
Exactly. So, the emperors start murdering each other. There start to be imperial plots, and the armies, factions go against each other, and everything starts to fall apart on the inside. So this is absolutely what happened to the Persian Empire. It reaches its maximum extent, and then the collapse begins. And the collapse starts after the Peloponnesian War, around 404 BC. The Persian Emperor, by this point, we have an emperor called, for what it's worth, well, the names aren't that important, but, never mind the names, really, actually. It's not worth it. The emperor is having trouble keeping control of the empire, and his own brother begins to plot against him. And he recruits the Spartans, and he says, I'm going to go and conquer the empire, and I want you to help. The Spartans were seduced by this idea. They thought, hey, this is, if we can now go and conquer Persia, right, this will take away that enemy. We'll have an ally from now on. And again, balance of power type calculations. This is going to be a good outcome for us. So the Spartans committed their own men and an army of Greek mercenaries known as the 10,000 to this expedition. So that's why this is called Route of the 10,000. And Xenophon is the historian who tells the story. He was a Greek historian, and he was a general in this army that accompanied the brother of the emperor in his rebellion against the emperor. And the reason why it's a significant episode is because look what happens here. This army penetrates all the way into the heart of the empire, into Mesopotamia. Only then did the Persian emperor assemble an army, gigantic army, and repelled them, and the Greeks went back here and then back. But the rebellion failed, but what was amazing about it was for the Greeks to get firsthand knowledge of what the empire looked like. This was this massive empire, and you look at it from the outside, or you look at it on a map, and it's always really big and impressive. But you can never see on a map, or from the outside of an empire, is what's really going on in here. What is life really like in here? What are all the challenges that the emperor faces to keep this thing that he's gotten control of? It's ugly. There has never been an example of a nice situation. No matter how benevolent of an empire you've got. The best one ever in history was the British Empire. That's the best that ever was. The most, it's a strange word to use, but the most benevolent empire ever created was the British Empire. But even then, I mean, it's just impossible to maintain it. And World War II caused its collapse. And then the British had to let go of everything. But the inside's always ugly. All the stuff that you got to do to keep control, no matter how nice you're trying to be, or what you're trying to teach people to do. And the British in particular were trying to spread new, Western values to the rest of the world. Doesn't matter. Anyway, Persia was nowhere near that good. And it was a mess. And the Greeks learned it. So it was very significant because the expedition of the 10,000 turned out to be very significant because what it revealed to the Greeks was how hollow and corrupt the Persian Empire was. That was powerful knowledge. It wasn't quite this thing that they thought it was. And it was in the process of collapsing. It was becoming more and more susceptible to advances from the outside. And as we'll see, that's what's coming up in the story. But first, Greece has got to get a little bit more of a mess going on here. So they meddle in the Persian Empire. The Persian emperor manages to overthrow this rebellion or stop this rebellion. And then he decides he's going to meddle in Persian affairs. And he starts providing support to Athens and Thebes and Corinth against Sparta, sending them money to fight Sparta. Now, Athens is weak here. It's definitely the lesser of them. And so it's at this point that another one of the Greek city-states rises up to become more important than either Athens or Sparta. And what they did was, has to do with this pretty wild-looking diagram here, which on this one is labeled the Macedonian phalanx, but it was first innovated by somebody before the Macedonians, so we'll get to that later, but it was first created by the Thebans. And so the reason why this is such a powerful formation is because you're using these long spears, multiple layers of them, and you're laying down, you're setting up this integrated front of this formation that is just impossible to penetrate. It's even more effective than the Spartan phalanx because of the additional layers, right? The level of integration, I guess is what you could say, pertaining to this phalanx. The Thebans invented this and defeated the Spartans and the rest of Greece, as anybody else that was not on their side. The Thebans defeated and temporarily took over Greece. It's brief and it deserves no more mention than that. But for a while, Thebes was the number one city in Greece. Only by conquering the rest of Greece, the Thebans ended up inadvertently showing how you do things to somebody that turned out to be a military genius and was going to turn the tables even on them. If you don't know who I'm talking about, well, I'll tell you tomorrow. So, that's it for now. The Greeks are at each other's throats. They're meddling in Persian affairs. The Persians are meddling in their affairs. It's just all one big mess. Very sad. Now Thebes is in charge. That's it for now, folks. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.